We advertised tonight's call as Soils 101, which was, I think, shorthand, but the focus tonight's going to be certainly more on soil fertility and fertiliser use, judging by the questions so far and just talking to our speaker earlier about what we want to cover tonight. And it must be a hot topic. It's been very popular. I think we've got about 180 people registered for the call, and we've certainly had a heap of questions come in. And when fertiliser and associated costs, I had a look at the beef and lamb farm survey data account for about 20% of farm work and expenses. There's probably no reason to wonder why it's a bit of a hot topic. But after the question of what's absolutely the best breed of sheep and or beef to run on a farm, there's probably no issue that's debated as much as fertilisers and soil management in New Zealand sheep and beef farming. And it's been interesting, you know, as New Zealand sheep and beef farming's been restricted to the more extensive, higher and drier country over the past decade or two, I'd say, ironically, the discussions have probably only intensified around what works, what doesn't, and why. And we were also talking beforehand, there's a renewed appreciation for legumes, I think, in our systems, be it lucerne, annual clovers, or the trusty red and white clovers, and some of the clover and herb mixes. So that's increased interest in the science, and some might say the art of feeding legumes and not just generic pasture. So our guest tonight, Dr. Doug Edmeads, if you've ever pondered questions about fertiliser and soil fertility, you've probably read or listened to him speak at a beef and lamb field day or an event like that. I know at our beef and lamb events, Doug's one of our most popular guest speakers. He never shies away from a debate, and he's fairly clear in his recommendations, and has had some other high profile issues that have made him well known around about the place. So look, without further ado, welcome to the call, Doug. In a couple of minutes, we'll get you underway with, I guess, the elevator pitch or the key things you'd like to get across before we get into the questions and answers. But maybe just to start off with the potted history, how did you end up where you are now? What's been sort of your work career that's brought you to this point?
Well, that question's coming from out of left field. Brought up on a dairy farm. My father was interested in fertilisers, had some pretty wacky ideas. They interested me. I was encouraged to go off to university and study these things, and so that's been my passion, understanding soil fertility, past nutrition, and the research that goes into that, and getting the message out to the farmer. I think I got a double dose of the McMeekin gene. McMeekin was passionate that science was no good unless it was applied on the farm, and I certainly have got a double dose of that gene, and I'm very strident and very forceful about making sure that the science message gets out onto the farm. I'm not saying I'm right, I'm saying there's the science message. Take it or leave it.
All right. So, some of the listeners may have read your book, Science Friction, and in that, and I've heard you refer elsewhere to, I think, your famous farmer from Ngātia that challenged you with a question. So what we've sort of posed tonight is, okay, you're in an elevator with a farmer from Ngātia or Winton in Southland or wherever it may be. It's your elevator pitch. You've got a couple of minutes. What are the things you're going to stress to them to think about, to understand, to get right with soil fertiliser management?
There's no doubt in my mind that I think we have lost our way, lost sight of the importance of a clover-based pasture. I'm talking about white clover, ryegrass pastures. We have lost sight of what a good white clover, ryegrass pasture looks like. And because of that, we are not performing as we could do. There's a huge, in my view, untapped potential in our hill country, in our sheep and beef sector, to improve productivity. That's productivity, I said, not production. Productivity by getting our soil fertility correct. The most important part is getting the clover growing. Clover has a very poor root structure, and as a consequence, it has a high requirement for all nutrients. So the clover is the canary in the mine. If your pastures are not performing and do not contain the proper amounts of clover, then chances are there is a nutrient limitation. Now, importantly, clover requires, like all plants, 16 nutrients. And more important than that, it can only grow as fast as the most limiting nutrient. So what that means in practice is that, and particularly relevant to the sheep and beef sector, is that the old recipes of, say, years ago, where on the sedimentary soils, putting only needed P and S and the right pH and molybdenum, things would go well. A consequence of that is we've mined out all the potassium in these soils, and now one of the most frequent deficiencies we're finding in the hill country, sheep and beef sector, is potassium deficiency. The point I'm making is that the clover plant can only grow as fast as the most limiting nutrient. The limiting nutrient is analogous to the weak link in the chain. There's no point in throwing more and more super on a soil which is potassium deficient or molybdenum deficient or hasn't got the right pH.
All right. So let's get straight into it. The questions, I think some people have heard you speak, and that's the question they asked. So you've mentioned particularly potassium, potash there. Mm-hmm. How widespread is potassium deficiency? Is it the one of the key elements that you see as the most significant around the...
In my practice, and that covers farms North Island and South Island, the most frequent limiting nutrient we find in clover-based pastures is potassium. So it's become a real problem, and we're not recognising it as the important nutrient that it is. Now, some people say I've gone overboard with potassium. I'm not overstating it. I'm saying that there are 16 nutrients which the clover plant requires. If one is limiting, potassium, then there's no point in putting the rest on. Or put it another way, you get your biggest bang for your fertiliser buck by chasing after the most limiting nutrient, whether that's K or sulphur or maybe phosphorus. So it's very, very important to get the balance correct for the clover to grow. Now, why is the clover important? Well, we need to relearn the importance of clover in our pastures. Clover, a kilogram of clover ryegrass pasture, the marginal cost for growing that is about 4 to 5 cents. That is our competitive advantage that we've enjoyed worldwide. But we've lost sight of that important equation, and we are covering it up with using nitrogen fertilisers or believing that it's a pasture persistence problem, when in fact the fertility isn't right for the clover to grow and for the clover to put nitrogen back in the system. So the advantage of clover is that it puts nitrogen into the system, and more importantly than that, it is a better stock feed. So you get more production per kilogram of clover than you do from ryegrass. So if you haven't got the soil fertility balanced in terms of all those 16 nutrients, you're missing out on two important components. The pasture quality declines, and you're not getting that free nitrogen going in to make sure that the ryegrasses persist.
All right. Let's get into the big issue. So you talked, your analogy is about the key elements and the weakest link in the chain and correcting that one. And we'll come back to potassium and the importance of that. The other common theory about there is around ratios why do you go with your weakest link versus the ratios and balances? And we've only got an hour. So.
Okay, that's a good question. In the mid-30s, two theories emerged, competing theories about plant nutrition. One said that the ratios were important. You had to have the ratio of potassium to magnesium, whatever it is, right. And once those ratios were in the correct balance, things were fine. The plant would produce to maximum. The other theory said the plant doesn't give a damn about ratios. It is only concerned about the minimum amount of each of those 16 nutrients. Now, we've had almost 100 years of research on this topic, and I've contributed to it myself. And the jury is well and truly out. Plants don't give a damn about ratios. They're only concerned about having the minimum amount of each nutrient required for pasture growth. So we now have a mature science where we know what those nutrients are, the 16 nutrients. We know how to measure them. We know what quantities are required in the soil by soil testing and clover-only testing. And so we have, from this mature science, a good handle on what is wrong with the pasture and how to get it right.
Okay. So you talked about that, coming back to the weakest link analogy again, how do you go about, or how do you suggest farmers go about identifying what are the weakest links?
It's very, very important to have a good monitoring program, and I'll cover that off shortly. When you think about it, the soil fertility is the foundation for your building called your business enterprise. It's the foundation. And so if you're not taking good care of that foundation and monitoring it regularly, then you're not, I'll put it in the positive sense. If you're an enlightened farmer and want to progress, you've got to look after that foundation to make sure you've got that clover growing and everything else falling into place. So it's very, very important to have a good monitoring program. What do I mean by that? I mean having set up, typically when I go onto a farm, I'll look at the farm and look at the various aspects of the farm, topography, soil group, blah, 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 and then work out the various blocks on the farm, blocks being areas of similar topography, soil group, land use, etc., or financial profitability. And having established what the blocks are, then you choose a monitor paddock or paddock within each block, and that becomes your monitor paddock, and you go back and walk the same transects year after year, getting soil tests from there. But not just soil tests. As I said before, the clover is the canary in the mine. And so if there's something wrong with the soil fertility on the farm, the clover plant will be the first to see it. And so taking soil tests with clover only samples gives you a good picture of what is limiting on the farm. So if you're going to look after the foundation, you've got to have a good monitoring program to make sure you're using nutrients and fertilizers efficiently.
Okay. Just want to drill into that a wee bit better. So soil tests and herbage tests?
Yes, yep. And I'm being specific there. Herbage tests. There are two types of herbage tests. If I went onto a farm and you told me, I've got an animal health problem, I would be worried about the nutrients going down the animal's throat, and hence I would take what is called a mixed herbage sample. Take a grab sample of what the animal's eating, whether it's dung and urine patches or poor areas in the paddock. Try to mimic what the animal's eating, because I want to know how much copper, cobalt, selenium, etc. is going down the animal's throat. But if you said to me, I've got a problem with clover. The clover is not persisting the way it should do. Remember, an ideal pasture is about 30% clover. The clover's not there. I think there's a problem. Then I would take a clover-only sample, being very, very careful to stay away from those nutrient-rich areas, dung and urine patches, troughs, fences, etc. To get a sample of clover, the struggling clover, we want to know why the clover's not growing. So you take a clover-only sample. And that supplements the soil tests results. We don't have soil tests for trace elements like molybdenum and boron, and so you need to take some clover-only samples also. So we really need to... soil fertility and pasture nutrition is a mature science, but we haven't kept ourselves up to date and are not using all the full... the full range of tools that science and technology can bring to the farm.
Thanks, Doug. So let's talk about fertiliser use then. I pulled out the statistics from the Beef and Lamb New Zealand Sheep and Beef Survey, which showed back in the mid-90s, and this is very averaged, we were putting on about 15 kilograms of fertiliser per stock unit. That went up to about 25 kilos early 2000s, and it's broadly declined since then. We're back down to around about 20 kilos. Are we putting on enough fertiliser, or is the issue the types of fertiliser we're putting on?
That's a good question. I think the figures are that the average sheep and beef farmer is spending about $10 to $12 on fertiliser per stock unit. And that's a benchmark. Sometimes it's reasonable to be above that, other times below that. My own view is that we are spending enough on fertiliser, but we're not spending that money on the most limiting nutrients, and hence we're not getting the biggest return on our fertiliser investment, and our farm is not as productive as it might otherwise be. Frequently we find phosphate levels are fine in soils, but for some reason or other we've forgotten about the potassium or the sulphur or the molybdenum, and you're going to get nowhere on that particular recipe. Old recipes do not work. We must upgrade our way of thinking about fertiliser. And I like to get farmers to think not about, a farmer will say, well, last year I put on $10,000 or $50,000, whatever number, of fertiliser. And I say, yes, but what type? And I say, oh, it's 30%, da-da-da-da-da. And I'll say, yes, but how much of each nutrient went on? That's the important thing, how much of each nutrient. So I like to get farmers to think about the active ingredient Let's get away from not talking about fertiliser anymore. Let's talk about last year I put on so many kilograms of P, K and S, or I put on so many kilograms of P, but not no potassium or sulphur. Now that gives you, might give you a clue as to what's limiting. So we need to revise the way we think of it and think of fertilisers as we think of agrochemicals in terms of the amount of active ingredient that is being applied in terms of the nutrients.
All right, let's talk about those nutrients then, and we've already mentioned potassium. Maybe expand a wee bit on the background of how we've got to the point where, I mean, traditionally, I think when people think of fertiliser, and I'm probably the same myself, you think of phosphate.
Mm-hmm.
It's been the key nutrient, the most important one.
Mm-hmm.
What is the state now and how we've got to that point? And then, what's the role of potassium? Potassium deficiency lead to?
Well, I think... The sheep and beef sector, historically, most of our sheep and beef is grown on sedimentary soils. Now, these soils had reserves of potassium. You didn't need to put on fertiliser potassium. And so superphosphate was an excellent product as we developed those soils. But we've been farming these soils now for, in many cases, over 100 years. And we've sent a lot of that potassium overseas to England and Europe and elsewhere. And so we've now depleted the soil of potassium in particular. And so that's why we're seeing potassium coming up so frequently. Now, I'm not... People say, well, I'm just being fixed on potassium. I hope that doesn't come across. I'm saying that potassium is one of the 16 nutrients. They all need to be present. But it just so happens that at the moment potassium tends to be the one that's most frequently deficient. Now, the benefits you get from correcting potassium deficiency are enormous. Moving a soil, if you say got a soil test level of potassium of say 4 and move it up to say 6-7, the pasture production is going to increase by about 30-40%. So people look at potassium and say, oh, it's very expensive, and I say, Wait. No, it isn't. A kilogram of potassium costs the same as a kilogram of nitrogen. You're happy to put on 100 or 150 kilograms of N, but when it's of potassium, you blink and say, oh, that's far too expensive. The other point to make is that a kilogram of nitrogen from fertilizer will only last about 4 to 6 weeks, but a kilogram of potassium lasts, well, there you go, you see, for a lot longer. We can't continue to farm these soils running them on potassium deficient or sulfur deficient or molybdenum deficient soils. So what I'm saying is that whatever the nutrient is, we've got to get the quantity of each of those 60 nutrients up so that it's not limiting clover growth, get that clover growth going, get that nitrogen back in the system, get the ryegrass growing, and you're in business.
Mm-hmm. So we have... bandied around economic analysis of the use of nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So 1 kilogram of nitrogen and a 10-to-1 response is going to carry an extra kilogram of dry matter for, is it 10 cents, 12 cents?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Is there similar for potassium?
Yes, I can conjure up some numbers. Conjure up, that's the wrong word. The science would tell us that we know what the relationship is between the amount of soil potassium in the soil, and I just have an aside here. There was a test that used to be applied called the potassium reserve test, TBK I think it was called. That I did a review of all the potassium trials done in New Zealand over the past 50, 60 years, published a couple of years back. That test is no longer appropriate. The best measure of the amount of plant available potassium in the soil is the Quick Test K. Now, if the Quick Test K level is 4, then increasing it up to the optimal range of about 7 to 10, you'll increase production by about 30 to 40%. Now, that's a huge increase in production. And, of course, that the benefit of that greatly offsets the cost of putting on potassium fertiliser. It's just a no-brainer, really. To me, I think it's crazy people saying, well... It's not economic to correct potassium deficiency. Let me give you an analogy. If you went along to the doctor and had a test and he said, you've got type A diabetes, but it's not economic to correct that. Sorry, bugger off. The same analogy applies. You can't farm with one of those nutrients limiting protection. It's as simple as that. And so bite the bullet and get on with life and get on with farming and enjoy it.
So I don't want to keep harping on potassium, but I don't know whether people have been listening to you or what, but it seems half the questions have come in around that. What is actually the role of potassium, and is it something other than a reduction in total dry matter production that are looking at a pasture, when you walk into a pasture or if a farmer walks out to the pasture, are there signs of potassium deficiency?
Oh, yes. In fact, in terms of pasture assessment, potassium deficiency is the easiest thing to assess. If I go onto a farm and look at a paddock and it's very, very patchy, the dung and urine patches are standing out, obviously, and the pasture in between is weedy or the clover is not vigorous, and the clover is vigorous in the dung and urine patches, I can guarantee you that's a nutrient deficiency, probably of potassium, but also could be sulfur and also maybe phosphorus. So it depends on what symptoms you're seeing in the clover. Potassium deficient clover has a brown ring around the edge of the leaves. That's a classic symptom of potassium deficiency. But go and have a look tomorrow when you wander across the farm and look at where the clover is growing vigorously and green and healthy and where it's not. And if there's more clover growing in the urine patches than away from it, then it's a good clue that potassium is deficient because urine is very rich in potassium. So these symptoms are, once you know what you're looking for, are pretty clear about, in terms of, you can learn a lot from the underlying soil fertility by knowing what symptoms to look for on top of it. For example, if the clover is growing in the dung patches and not away from it, then that's a clue that either phosphorus or sulfur is deficient. Now, sulfur-deficient clover plant will be very yellow. So that's another symptom that you can look out for. But the point is, if you haven't put any nitrogen fertilizer on and the pastures are poxy, very dung and urine patches are prominent, I can guarantee you there's an underlying nutrient problem. Now, let me emphasize this point. The color of the pasture. Now, because animals don't put nutrients back evenly, we will always have pasture which is of different height. You know, there's more growth under a dung and urine patch or above it than elsewhere. So there will always be a difference in height. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the composition. The composition should be a constant amount of clover right through the pasture, and the colour, the pasture growing between the dung and urine patches should look dark green. So there should be a uniform green colour in a healthy pasture. Don't worry about the height, worry about the composition and the colour.
All right. So, still some more questions on potassium. Is it just like the other ones where there's the soil test is a good indicator, the optimal level is what you should aim for? Is there any advantage going above optimal levels on soil tests?
No advantage in going above, and that applies to all the soil tests. There's no point in farming above the optimal nutrient levels because you're just wasting money. We do know what the relationship is between soil K and pasture production, and the optimal range is around about 7 to 10, and that applies to all soils, not just sedimentary soils, but all soils. And that's where we've fallen down the past. We've sort of said to ourselves as scientists, well, we've got this reserve K test, it must be telling us something, and therefore you can farm at lower quick test levels. That is not what the latest science is saying, I'm afraid. So we need to refresh our mind about potassium, but the same applies to sulfur. We now have two soil tests for sulfur. There are two forms of sulfur in the soil, plant-available sulfur. One is the sulfate pool, which makes up a very small part of the plant-available pool, about 5%, less than 5%. The most important pool is the organic S pool, and that makes up about... Sulfate makes up less than 5%. The organic sulfur test is about 95%. It's the biggest and most important pool. And yet, how many people know to ask when you're putting them soil samples into the system, tick the box saying organic sulfur? If you don't tick that, you'll just get sulfate sulfur, and that won't be much help because sulfate sulfur levels bobble up and down like a horse draws. Organic sulfur is the major test for sulfur requirements. On our soils. So we've got all this, and going on from there, similar with Olsen P, we know what the relationship is between the Olsen P level in soil and the relative pasture yield. So in other words, we've calibrated these tests, we can interpret what they mean, and then give fertiliser advice based on that interpretation.
So you've touched on two things there, phosphate and reserves and retention, which I want to move on to next. But just while we've been having that discussion, one specific question that's come in on, and this will be the last one on potassium, unless there's some, how many units of K to lift the one unit in the test?
Now, this is where farmers get frightened, so I'll break it to you gently. The science says that you need 70 kilograms of K per hectare, that's 150 kilograms of potash, to raise the level by one unit. Now, that's not dissimilar to saying you need 150 kilograms of N to maintain production. We're used to saying, talking about those amounts of N, but not with potassium. So you do need large amounts of potassium over and above maintenance to have an effect. Now, I hear a lot of people say, oh, yeah, we put some potassium on last year and nothing improved and the soil test didn't go up. Then you quiz them and say, how much did you put on? How much of the active ingredient actually went on? And they say, oh, about 30, 40, never used potassium before, that's a big amount. And I'll say, well, look, you're pissing into the breeze, sunshine. That's not going to be enough to correct, in any major sense of the word, any deficiency. So potassium, large amounts. Now, let me just explain that so it can be more readily understood. If you look at the nutrient concentration in pasture, you'll see that the nitrogen levels are typically, let's say, around 4%, and the potassium level is around 4% too. But for P and S, the levels are about 10 times less than that, 0.4. In other words, what that means is there's 10 times more nitrogen and potassium being cycled in the soil pasture animal system than there is P and S. So we used to think about P and S in terms of 30 to 40, 50 kilograms of those nutrients. We have to upsize our mind and realize that with potassium, it's large amounts that have to go into the system to make the whole thing work properly. Now, clovers are particularly sensitive to potassium deficiency, and one of the major effects you'll see if you correct potassium deficiency is a big increase in clover growth. That can be a bit daunting for some farmers, but it settles back. You'll get a dominance of clover for a while. And that clover is putting nitrogen into the system, that encourages the ryegrass, and so over time it comes back to a better balance of, say, 30% clover and 70% ryegrass. But you will go through that phase of clover dominance, just as you do when you plant maize or plant a crop and suck all the nitrogen out. You go through a period of clover dominance after that. But that's just the way the system works. The only precaution really is that it's not really a worry for sheep and beef farms, but bloat could be a problem with more clover going down the throat.
Right, that's it. I'm done with K, potash. Unless there's more questions come in and we have time. But so I want to move on. The big one we've always talked about, and you've stressed the importance of not just talking about fertiliser, but talking about the nutrients that are going on. But one of the main ones has always been phosphorus. And the big question around phosphorus is the relationship between Olsen P test and retention and what P retention means. So first, when we have the question that come in, here's it specifically, they have high P retention soils, 98%. Can you explain what this means?
The P retention test is simply a measure of how big the phosphorus tank is in the soil. Our volcanic soils have phosphate retention levels of around about 80 to 100%. They've got big tanks. So what that means in practice is to get the clover pasture up and running, you have to put on large amounts of capital fertilizer. Go to a sedimentary soil where the P retention might be, say, 30 or 40. The nutrient tank is much smaller, so you don't have to put on those large amounts of capital P to get started. That's all it means. The flip side of that is that the bigger the tank, the further you can go. And so once you've got the tanks on a volcanic soil up and running, the P tanks, then you can go for a long way. And with a sedimentary soil with lower P retention. So think of, I always envisage nutrients in the soil as Are the nutrient tanks full? So we're talking about pure retention, that's the size of the tank for phosphorus in the soil. Now, analogously, the pool, the size of the tank for, say, cations, potassium, is the cation exchange capacity. They're analogous in that sense. It's just a measure of how big the tank is that you have to fill up to get the pasture underway. Now, how does that relate to Olsen P? Olsen P is measuring not the size of the tank, but the amount of plant available nutrient is in your tank. Now you've got to get the tank full to get the Olsen P level up to, say, the optimal range for a volcanic soil. So they're measuring two different things. The other point I'll make about the Olsen P test is that many in the fringe brigade will rubbish it and say, well, it wasn't developed for these soils. And it's true, it wasn't. It just so happened that back in the 50s and 60s, a lot of research was done. There's lots of different soil tests for phosphorus being promulgated and used around the world. And those early soil scientists that predated me did lots of trials comparing, saying, well, we'll compare the Olsen P test with the Bray test, with the Morgan test. There's a whole bunch of them. And it just so happens that for our soils, the test that best predicts pasture yield is the Olsen P test. So the calibration, that's the best soil test we've got for available P, is the Olsen P test.
So use that analogy of the tank then, and say whether it's relatively small in sedimentary soil or large in the volcanic soils, how much P are we talking in that tank? This is leading on to the question of how we get access to that, or can we get access to that?
As a rule of thumb, the Olsen P test is measuring about less than 10% of the total pool of available P in the soil. Mm-hmm. So it's as a proxy. It's a proxy for the total amount of available P in the soil. That's all it is. So it's measuring a proportion of the available P in the soil.
So why can't we, and this is, comes up a lot, let's get access to all that locked up P that's just sitting there instead of put more on.
Yeah, okay. Well, firstly, let's go back to the P retention test. The P retention test is and was developed exactly for that. It's a measure of a soil property, how big the tank is. P retention does not mean P fixation. The term P retention has been taken out of context by the Wacky Brigade and turned into a selling point. They will say, oh, look, the P retention on the soil is so big that all the phosphorus you're going to put on is going to get fixed, locked up forever. That's not what the P retention test measures, never has measured, never will measure. It's simply P retention is measuring the size of the tank to which you need to fill up to make the plant grow. So we need to revisit what that P retention thing means. It does not mean that P is fixed and locked up. It does not mean that at all. In fact, people have, it's true that when you put P onto the soil, it is converted into organic P forms or inorganic P forms, which cannot be leached. And that's a great thing, because if phosphate leached like nitrate, we'd have a huge problem with water quality. So P retention is a good thing. It means that P, you put it on, it stays fixed in the soil, and that P is available for plant growth when required. So it's not true that it's locked up and unavailable forever. That never has been true and never will be true.
Is there, playing with that analogy again, sedimentary soil, a smaller tank than volcanic, is there a way to make the tank in volcanic soil smaller so you don't have to fill it up with as much?
No, it's a property of the soil. Our volcanic soils can accumulate very large quantities of organic matter because of their mineralogy. And so that's a property of the soil, and that's a good property of the soil. So just see it, the P retention as a measure. In my practice, I use it as when I first want to farm, I'll often get the peer retention test done, because that tells me what soil group I'm dealing with, whether it's an ash soil, or sedimentary soil, a pumice soil, or a peat soil. Peats have got no mineral or very little mineral matter in them, so they have very large, little peer retention, whereas the volcanic soils are the other extreme. So it's just simply a property of the soil which tells us, as soil scientists, something about the chemical makeup of the soil. And that's all it is and should be used for.
Let's talk about the Olsen P test then. So there's always a bit of debate around the level you should be aiming for.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Olsen P optimums are an economic optimum. Do you want to explain a wee bit about that and how that may mean there is room to adjust that optimum, possibly even within a farm or certainly between farm types?
That's a good question. Once again, there's a lot of confusion around this subject, and once again I'll repeat what I've said before. I had the opportunity to review all the phosphorus trials on pastures in New Zealand, and that updated us in terms of what are the levels required for near maximum production, etc., etc. And it so happens that from that science we can say that for peat and pumice soils you need an Olsen P of around about 40 to 45 to get near maximum production. For volcanic and sedimentary soils, you need an Olsen P of about 35 to 40. Now that's a measure of, that's what you need to get to maximum production. I'm not saying every farmer should be there. Most dairy farmers will be, because their gross margins, the amount of money they make per kilo in dry matter is so high. For the sheep and beef sector, it's somewhat different. You need to work out what the economic optimal level might be. So I'll give you some idea of what that might be. If you are a very high producing bull farm with a gross margin of say $1,500 per hectare, then the economic optimal might be 25-30. Now it's the economic optimal means you're not maximising production, you're maximising profitability. And I think this is another area where we need to revise our whole way of going about giving fertiliser advice. And in the sheep and beef sector, it should be based not on what we did last year, not on what the neighbour did or what you heard down at the pub or whatever have you. We need to move our fertiliser advice and recommendations onto an economic basis, so that we're making decisions about fertiliser, whether it's P or K or S, based on the economic outcome of achieving certain levels of soil fertility. I think that's the next reform that we need to go through in our advice to health country farmers.
So you can take that further. You know, farmers should be applying that within their farm. There's some areas that rather than a 20 for the whole farm, they should be saying 25, some
25. Quite so. And that's very, very important. I made comment before about going onto a farm and you'd define the farm in terms of various blocks. And one of those means of defining it is to say, well, look, here's some high country on this farm. Here's some middle country and here's some flats. Now, you make much more money off the flats. Therefore, they should be at Olsen P, say, 25-30. Whereas on the hills, where the gross margin is very low, or the productivity is low, then it's sensible to run them at Olsen P's of, say, 10-15. So once again, it's a matter of going onto a farm and saying, here are the different productive blocks on the farm, here are the economic optimal levels that I should be aiming for on each of those blocks, and here's the fertiliser program to get you there.
And I said I wouldn't, but a potassium question, same for potassium, optimum, variable, optimum levels?
Good question. This is the view I take. If you look at the cost of nutrients, phosphorus is the most expensive nutrient. It costs around about $3 to buy a kilogram of phosphorus. At the other extreme, sulfur is dirt cheap in relation to that. It costs about 70 cents for a kilogram of sulfur. And potassium costs about $1.40, the same as a kilogram of nitrogen. So the approach I take when I'm developing a fertilizer program for a farm, because P is the most expensive nutrient, I do an economic optimization based on phosphorus. That tells me the Olsen P range that I've got to work to, and then I bring all the other nutrients up so they're not limiting the expression of the most important and most expensive nutrient. That's the approach I take. But, and that's that is, as I say, a pragmatic development of my way of thinking through this issue.
Okay. So speaking of ways of getting phosphorus on and cost of phosphorus and so on, RPR, you've had some involvement with this in the past, I know of. What's... Is it a cheaper way of getting phosphate on if you're prepared to delay, you know, the lag?
Yeah. Not these days. RPRs were introduced in the, late 80s. At that time, they were the two important things, the basis for which they introduced were two things. One, they were regarded as effective as soluble P fertilisers. So an RPR was regarded as agronomically as effective as a soluble fertiliser. And two, at that time, they were about 30% cheaper per total P applied. As the science came in, we realised that that RPRs were not agronomically equivalent, and the best of the RPRs dissolved at about 30% per year. So when you factor that into the economics, RPRs weren't cost-effective relative to soluble fertiliser. Nowadays, we don't have to worry about all that detail because per kilogram of total P, RPRs are more expensive than soluble fertilisers. So it's just a no-go area as far as I'm concerned, unless you're into organics, and under the organic regime, RPR is the only source of P you can use. In my practice, I never recommend RPRs these days. They simply price themselves off the market.
Mm-hmm. So the other part of that question was, does that lag and that time for it dissolve... If you into an RPR program, you'll lag behind a soluble phosphorus program, but do you eventually catch up?
Well, in theory, the theory says that if the rate of dissolution is about 30%, for the best one, the Sashura RPR, if the rate of dissolution is 30%, then it takes about 4 years of annual applications so that you build up residues to give you provide you with a total amount of soluble P fertiliser. That's the theory. And as our science developed, we learned that the Sashura RPR was the most reactive, 30%, but there are other RPRs brought into the country which were 10%. Only 10% of the P became available in the year of application. In other words, you never caught up. I have a number of clients who have gotten into the RPR regime on the basis that, well, I've been in it so long, I might as well stay in it. Well, that's just bonkers, because if you're going to stay in it, you're just simply now paying more money for a kilogram of P than you were before. So what's the point? They've priced themselves off the market. End of story, go away.
Okay. Related to that, and I think it's related to phosphorus, but it's, you know, a fertiliser issue in New Zealand, a cadmium is a contaminant. Mm-hmm. Just had a question around that. What's the status of that? Is it something we should worry about and be taking... cognizance of when we select fertilisers to apply?
I don't think it's a major. The fertiliser industry, I don't very often say nice things about the fertiliser industry, but I will on this moment. They have set up a very good system for measuring and monitoring cadmium levels in soils. Cadmium comes in as a contaminant in the phosphate rock, by the way. So they've set up a system whereby you can. They've got four categories of levels in soils which trigger certain actions. I don't think it's a major. It's certainly not on the radar, along with say nitrate leaching or phosphorus runoff. No.
Okay. All right. So we've sort of been talking about the major elements, the major nutrients, and want to get into some of the more trace elements, molybdenum. Mm-hmm. How important is it? What's its role? How do we manage molybdenum to ensure we're getting good, healthy clovers? It's particularly important for legumes. And so how do we... Can we measure it? Can we monitor it? Yep. What do we do?
Molybdenum deficiency was first discovered in New Zealand back in the early 50s. And I'm intrigued 50, 60 years later. I'm out there and I'm finding cases of molybdenum deficiency. It should not happen. It really shouldn't. I'll start again. Molybdenum is a trace element, and it's required by the rhizobia in the nodules on the clover roots. It's part of the chemical that breaks down nitrogen gas into protein in the plant. So although you only require tiny amounts of molybdenum, in the absence of molybdenum, the clover won't be there because it can't fix nitrogen. So it has to be present. Now, what happened initially was that on these molybdenum deficient soils, farmers would put these little amounts of molybdenum on and the clover would blaze away. Suddenly it's away. And farmers being farmers said, oh shit, that was good, we'll double the amount next time, da da da. And over a period of time, the molybdenum levels in the soils increased. And what that meant was that the animals were there and therefore ingesting molybdenum, which was interfering copper in utilisation of the animal, and so running into copper deficiency. So they then said, from their experience, told their sons, never use molybdenum on this farm. And now we're on the rebound from there, where farmers haven't used molybdenum when they should have been using molybdenum, and it's now caught up with them. Now, molybdenum is easy to monitor in the clover plant and in mixed herbicide samples. The safety margin is pretty wide. Providing you've got a good monitoring program, there should be no risk at all in running into molybdenum-induced copper deficiency. There should be no, you need a good monitoring program, soil tests, clover tests, mixed herbage tests.
Mm-hmm. But particularly herbage tests in there?
Yes. Yeah. Mixed herbage for the animal, what's coming down the animal's throat. Mm-hmm. Clover only, because that tells you how much is in there for the clover. So you need about 0.1 parts per million of molybdenum in the clover to get maximum production. But if the levels get over 1 parts per million in the mixed herbage, then that could be interfering with the copper utilisation in the animal. So that's a real problem. But once again, if you have a good monitoring program, I repeat what I said before, soil fertility is the foundation for your business. The cost of running a monitoring program is very little in relation to the total investment you've got in your farm and your fertiliser program.
Okay, so the next couple of questions as we sort of wrap up the call are actually around pH and lime, which gets put in with soil fertiliser. It's not technically a nutrient, but it's a condition of the soil, I guess, or you can explain that a wee bit more. So before we start getting it, I guess we'll lay some of the groundwork about what lime does, why pH is important, and what it is in lime that works. It's not just lime per se, it's components of the lime.
Well, once again, I invite people to think of the active ingredient. Lime comprises mainly calcium carbonate. The active ingredient, the reason why we apply it, is not the calcium. Our soils have got heaps of calcium in them, which I'll explain shortly. It's the carbonate that we add to the soil, which reacts with the acid and increases the pH. So the active ingredient is the carbonate content, so you should buy lime on its calcium carbonate, on its carbonate content, not on its calcium content. Now, why do we not have calcium deficiency? Yes, calcium is important in bones and all that sort of stuff, that's true. The fact is, our soils, especially the sedimentary soils, are very recent. So in other words, they haven't had time to weather, like an old weathered soil in say, Australia. So that they're not very weathered. Secondly, we put on a lot of calcium and superphosphate. Superphosphate contains 20% calcium. So calcium deficiency, per se, is unheard of in this country of ours. So we put lime on because of the carbonate. It's the carbonate which changes the pH, and it's the change in pH which gives rise to all the other benefits of liming. Now, those benefits are many. One of the most important and universal benefits is of course, bugs. The soil bugs are most active at a pH around about 5.8 to 6. And so that's why the recommendation is that we should maintain pHs of around about 5.8 to 6 on our pastures. That's assuming you're ground-spreading lime, not flying it on. If you're flying it on, the economic optimal pH is around about 5.6. So if the pHs are above that, then you don't get a return off your lime. So the two points to bear in mind, ground spread, 5.8 to 6, no excuses. But for hill country, if it has to be flown on, then the economic optimum is 5.5 to 5.6.
Okay. So why?
So one of the we're talking about the benefits. Increase the biological activity in the soil. On some soils, it can increase the molybdenum availability of the soil. Molybdenum's in the soil that's not plant available. Change the pH and it becomes available. And that's one of the well-recognised benefits of liming. Or it can be a negative, because if the molybdenum level is already high and you increase them further, you can induce copper deficiency. Once again, there are ways of managing those things so you're not running in the dark all the time. Other benefits, it's long been held that liming unlocks phosphorus from the soil. Well, that's garbage. There are a very, very few soils in New Zealand where that does happen, the yellow grey earths. But they're so minor that the general rule is because you're liming doesn't mean to say you can that you're going to unlock phosphorus, and hence if you lime you don't need to put on as much super. It doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. Not in reality.
Again, treat it as an economic optimum.
Yep.
Across farms, yep. And within farms.
Yep, very much so.
So why do soils get acidic over time? Is it the acid in the fertilisers?
Some fertilisers do add acids to the soil, but the effects of those at the rates of application we're talking about are minor. The big reasons for the acidification of soils is that there are some basic chemical, biochemical reactions in the soil which produce acids. I'll give you an example. Organic matter contains nitrogen. Bugs break that down into ammonia and then into nitrate. That biochemical process produces acid. And so there are a number of these biochemical reactions which produce acid in soils, and that's why the pHs will decline slowly over time. And the rate of decline is, for most of our sheep and beef country, what would it work out to be? Maybe equivalent to about 100 kilograms of limestone per hectare per year. So it's not very much. But we have a problem now in our whole country, especially where we need to find an economic way of getting some lime into our superphosphate to put it on. And that's where this question of granulated lime comes in to the equation, which I'm sure you're going to go on to. But before we go there, yes, if we don't find ways of getting some lime into our hill country, we're doomed, because the pHs will drop. Once they drop below about 5.3, 5.2, 5.1, the legume is very, very sensitive to acidity. It's going to disappear. So we've got to find ways. It's a major issue of sustainability of our hill country, I reckon. So we've got to find ways of getting some lime into our systems to counteract that natural acidification. It's not the fertiliser you're using. It's nothing you're doing, Mr. Farmer, that's causing the problem. It's a completely natural biochemical reaction in the soil. So don't think you can do something about it in that manner. So don't change your practices for that. We need to find ways of getting lime into the system. And the idea would be to have a granulated agricultural lime that you can back mix with superphosphate and add it in any proportion. Now, having said that, that's quite different from saying go and use one of these fine granulated lime products on the market. That's you're paying about $200 a tonne, $200-$300 a tonne for those materials, whereas agricultural lime is about $30 a tonne. So a very, very expensive way of buying carbonate. And I would not recommend using them at all because of the expense. What we've got to do quite genuinely is find a way of taking ordinary ag lime and making it into a granule that we can then dry mix back with superphosphate. But these so-called granulated lime materials are not cutting the ice as far as I'm concerned. And they're sold on a myth. I'll tell you why. They will say that because the lime is very, very fine, you only need a smaller amount. Now, let me put it to you this way. The rule of thumb is that a tonne of ordinary ag lime will change the pH by about 0.1 of a unit. If you put on, say, 100 kilograms of a fine lime, the increase in pH is 0.01. You won't measure it, it'll be of no practical value, but you've probably paid $200-$300 a ton for the excitement of doing that. So it's not a solution. We earnestly need to find a way around this problem. And I think we will one day, but I can't get the fertiliser interested at this stage.
Uh-huh. So am I correct, the same analogy there as you had with fertiliser, it's not the product, it's what's in it.
Mm-hmm.
Same yes. Applies to lime.
Absolutely. I try to get farmers to think of, say, I gave the figures before, phosphorus costs, if you buy superphosphate, take into account the value of the sulphur, then you're paying around about $3 for a kilogram of P. A kilogram of sulphur costs about 70 cents, a kilogram of potassium around about $1.40. I try to get farmers to work out how much they're paying per kilogram of active ingredient. That's the way to compare fertiliser.
So the same for carbon as in the line.
Same for carbon. Exactly the same principle applies.
Alrighty, look, I'm just looking at the time, so I've got one last question, and you've actually touched on it yourself because it's been a bit of a hot topic in soil and soil fertility management is not just the nutrients in soil, but the things that live in the soil. Ah. You call them the soil bugs.
Mm-hmm.
What is the impact of what you've talked about in terms of lime and the major 16 nutrients, and particularly the major ones, on those soil bugs and lugs and flora and fauna in the soil?
Well, the
so that they're important.
They're very, very important. Absolutely important. Soil biology is very, very important, especially in our legume-based pasture system. So you've got to feed the bugs. Now consider it this way: if you we're going back, tracing over some old grounds. 16 nutrients, get all those 16 nutrients together so the clover's going to grow. The clover feeds the grass. The animal cycles those nutrients around. And let's say you're growing 10 tonnes of dry matter per hectare per year and utilising 80% of that. That's 2 tonnes of dry matter going back into the soil. And that 2 tonnes is mainly carbohydrate, sugar. And that's what feeds the bugs. And there are many, many experiments show that exactly that thing, as you improve the soil fertility in a clover-based pasture and improve the nutrient cycling going on, because you get more litter going back in the soil, you'll get more earthworms and bacteria and fungi, etc., etc. That's the classic soil fertility understanding of how this legume-based pasture system works. So if you get the clover growing, then everything else will fall into place. You don't have to go out there and worry about, am I putting the super, it must be killing the earthworms, or that's all nonsense. It really is absolute nonsense. If you're worried about feeding the bugs, get some fertilizer on, get some active ingredients on, and go for it.
Brilliant. Thanks, Doug. Look, there's a number of things there we could actually probably ask more questions on and delve into deeper, but I'm just weary of time and how long we... like the calls to go for and how much of your time we can take up. So look, I will pull it to a close. We've come to the end of our time for tonight. So many thanks to you out there, the listeners who've dialed in and been sending in their questions. There's been a few coming in during the call, or certainly plenty came in today. We've amalgamated a few of them because there are a number on the same subject, but I hope you've had your questions answered. The recording will be up. If there's something you want to listen to again, it'll be on the podcast channel very soon, certainly in the next day or two. And with that, we'll flick out an email to let you know when it's up, and there'll be a few links in there to some interesting further reading and so on that we have and that Doug will share with you as well. So, look, finally, a very large thank you to our guest tonight, Dr. Doug Edmeads. Thanks for coming along, Doug. It's been a pleasure. I've heard you speak several times, and I thought we'd have a good call, and people were certainly keen to listen in, judging by the numbers. So
people might like to know that many of the topics we've covered tonight are covered in the thing I write called the Fertiliser Review. This is not a promo. It's on my website, free. There are 36 editions there. A lot of this material is covered there in much more detail than we've been able to do tonight.
Very good. And we'll make sure we put a link to some of that stuff on there when we send you out the email. So, look, yeah, and you can find a bit of other stuff and interesting reading on there. I think your columns and all sorts of stuff as well. So, look, thank you, Doug. And thank you to all of you out there, and good night.
Cheers.
You are about to end this meeting. To end.